goes back to something that Michael Christopher was just talking about last hour, which is that new dimension that Sammy brought to the band. And still the genius behind it is Eddie Van Halen. In fact, if I remember, I mean, that award-winning video was fought by Sammy Hagar. He didn't want to make it. He thought it was a bad idea. And, of course, he was incredibly wrong. It, like, swept the MTV Awards or whatever. I don't remember the whole story, but you know what I mean. And it was so cool because, like, that idea that if you remember right now, they were, through the whole video, they were flashing up things that were true right now. And yet they all still seem so timeless. Like, right now, justice is being perverted in a court of law. Right now, blacks and whites don't eat together very much. Right now, you could be outside. Right now, I mean, the light from a star is heading toward Earth. I mean, it's like, it was just really, it was very inventive. I love that video. I love the song. And we'll miss Eddie Van Halen as the whole nation, really, I think, at a certain level, with certain people, Eddie Van Halen was as close as we came for a generation for a rock god in the United States. And he was married to a rock goddess in Valerie Bertinelli, right? I mean, for so many baby boomers, it was, you know, every guy's first crush, Valerie Bertinelli. And then, oh, Eddie Van Halen gets married. And only, oh, he gets, on top of all of that, he gets Valerie Bertinelli. And she was there by his side in the end, too, which is nice, even though they hadn't been married for quite some time. So we'll get back to this conversation about Bon Scott and his death. And this always unsettled question about exactly how he died. That on a week when Van Halen lost Eddie Van Halen, but AC/DC said they're coming back together again. And we'll talk about that next with a music historian on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Michael Christopher, music historian, coming up. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll also give you the number so that you can join the conversation. Open lines starts at the top of the next hour, so a little bit to go before we get there. If I can digress one more second, though, because it's interesting, it's come up again on Twitter. Again, anybody wants to follow me at Deacon Punnett on Twitter, is this, there's a false claim about Eddie, which I love Eddie Van Halen. I think we've established that. But there's something that gets said a lot, that he invented the finger-popping style on the guitar. And I just don't think historically that's accurate. I think he innovated it, that finger-popping style where he essentially plays with his left hand and then moves the right hand up the fret, and they are bouncing strings essentially off of each other, sort of this tapping that gives these marvelous solos and these really cool little notes in there. But I think that actually goes back to what made Eddie Van Halen so cool, is he used an innovation that was originally invented by Paganini. And I think Paganini, early 19th century composer, was the first one to do that with the violin. I think that's kind of, that's even, the real story is even better than Eddie Van Halen invented it. He pulled that trick out of Paganini's bag, which makes it, to me, even cooler. No comment?
Oh.
Did I stump you?
No, I think that Paganini was definitely the first one to do it, but what inspired Eddie to do it was hearing Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin do his solo on the song Heartbreaker. And I believe that Jimmy Page would have drawn a lot more from Paganini than Eddie Van Halen might have. And I agree with you that he definitely brought it more to the forefront. And there were other people that were tapping too well before Eddie Van Halen. So you're right that it is kind of misinformation out there that he invented tapping. Harvey Mandel from Canned Heat apparently was tapping in the
60s. Oh, really?
But
I love that.
Nobody really remembers Harvey Mandel when you're talking about guitars. Nobody's putting him in the top 10. So it's the guy who gets more popular that, oh, he must be the guy that invented it since he's the one that we know it. But that obviously isn't the case. It was centuries before Eddie Van Halen that people were tapping.
And I'm pretty sure Phil Kagey was doing it too.
Oh, from Glass Harp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he was. I mean, I have seen no video evidence of it early in his career, but the guy who many people consider like the guitarist, he was amazing. Still is amazing. He's still alive, but
he's
still playing. Well, let's talk about Bon Scott. So, it's cool that AC/DC is getting back together again. Phil Rudd is back behind the drums.
And so is Brian Barr.
Yeah. Sorry to see Chris Slade go. He was the drummer that's been with him off and on for 15, 20 years almost now. Who, by the way, do you know this, that Chris Slade, who people would know him best from the AC/DC video for Thunderstruck, right? That he was the drummer on It's Not Unusual by Tom Jones.
That's right.
He played on that whole album.
He goes back a long ways, and Tom Jones was his first big break. And then, of course, he played in The Firm with Paul Rodgers and Jimmy Page. That was Jimmy's first band out of Led Zeppelin.
But he also played on Blinded by the Light. He played with Manfred Mann, which is kind of cool, too. But anyway, so Chris Slade is out at age 75, I think, as drummer for AC/DC. I think he's 75 this year. And Phil Rudd is back, who was one of the original drummers and has had all sorts of problems and been kicked out of the band and then was in jail for a long time, as you mentioned, and other things are happening. But now as much of the original lineup that can be found is back, and that's cool. And I think for a lot of people, maybe even the story of Bon Scott, who Bon Scott was in relationship to the success of AC/DC, may be in itself a forgotten story. So I'll ask you to explain Bon Scott, but save it before we get to the death part, because that's where I want to get to a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Bon Scott was the first real well-known singer of AC/DC. When you break it down, it's either, you know, a Bon Scott or an AC/DC, or a Brian Johnson in AC/DC. But they didn't really get popular outside of Australia, which is where they were based, and then in England and Europe with Bon Scott. They didn't do a ton of touring in the United States, and the States are notoriously difficult for bands outside of the country to break big, although they did with Highway to Hell, which is probably the best-known Bon Scott entry into the AC/DC catalog. You know, of course, the title track is the one that everybody knows. But a lot of people that are just casual fans, they don't even differentiate between the singers. They just think, oh, that's what they've always sounded like. That's the other guy.
Right.
When we tell them there was another guy before the current one, they're kind of shocked to hear it in some respects. But Bon Scott is looked at by the hardcore fans, I think, as the true original singer of AC/DC and the real voice of them.
Yeah, and he was there from the, not quite at the very beginning, but he bonded with the Young brothers, Angus and Malcolm, because they shared a Scottish heritage. And there's all sorts of reasons why they were really good together. But he was also, like other members were of AC/DC, except for Angus, he was a hard partier. There's nobody's disputing the alcohol abuse, the drug abuse that was going on with Bon Scott. It's just when you actually look at what happened on the night of his death that things start to get kind of weird. So walk us through the night. And there's the majoritarian story, and then there's the subversive version of the same story that people tell.
Yeah, it's really an interesting story, and one that wasn't really well known. I mean, you've always had mystery surrounding the death of rock stars. You mentioned earlier in the show Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison, but Bon Scott wasn't really one that people talked too much about until recent years. Now, the official story is AC/DC were in rehearsals for the follow-up to Highway to Hell, and they were recording it in London. Now, since Highway to Hell was kind of their breakthrough LP into the just a little sliver where they broke into the mainstream in the States,
right,
the pressure was really, really on to follow that up. So after rehearsals one day, Bon Scott decided to go out on the town in London and, you know, have a bit of fun at the clubs. And he went out with a friend of his girlfriend's whose name was Alistair. And Alistair went to the clubs with him. They did their party. And this is the official story. He drove him back to Bond's flat in the early morning hours after the bars had closed. And Bond was passed out. And Alistair couldn't wake him up. So he said, I'm just going to leave him there. And he went into his own flat. The next night, not even the next day, it took until the next night when Alistair finally went down to his car, Bond was still in there. He wasn't breathing. He was blue, obviously dead. And the official cause of death listed on the death certificate is acute alcohol poisoning. And there was a lot of misinformation. This happened in February of 1980. There was a lot of misinformation out there that maybe he froze to death and died of hypothermia. But at the time, the temperatures were actually above freezing. It was a little bit unseasonably warm, and they didn't even get down into the low 40s that night. So hypothermia is ruled out. And alcohol poisoning and that old standby, death by misadventure,
right,
is what was the official coroner's report.
Right, which, and by the way, there should be an official coroner's report of death by good adventure for somebody that really does it right, where you've done something really amazing. It was death by good adventure. But, yeah, so that's a catch-all term, undetermined. Misadventure can include suicide, include accidental drowning. It can include a lot of things, depending on the coroner. So, but the one thing they thought they knew was that he was left alone, and that sometime during that period of time when he was left alone in the car, he had choked to death, right?
Right. That's exactly it.
On what?
Well, he had choked to death on his own vomit from alcohol. He had, you know, he had alcohol poisoning, and that's what caused it. There was nothing else that it could have been, and that's what went down for years. That he choked to death on his own vomit because he drank way too much. Now, a couple years ago, a book came out called Bond, The Last Highway, The Untold Story of Bon Scott and AC/DC's Back in Black. Now, I happen to know the author of the book, Jesse Fink, and he's a really, really great author who researched his book like I've never seen anybody dig into something. He researched this book for years. It was the second one that he did on AC/DC. And he said that it wasn't that standard death by misadventure, choking on his vomit by, you know, drinking too much like a John Bonham, but he said that it was a heroin overdose. And a lot of people didn't want to hear that. They don't, especially the really hardcore fans of AC/DC who have gone through their whole lives thinking that Bon had just, you know, pulled a John Bonham, for lack of a better term. Nobody wants to think that their favorite musician was a junkie. It's one of those unfortunate tags that hangs on the death of Kurt Cobain or Alice in Chains' Layne Staley. They're two really incredibly talented singers, but they were junkies. Now, Jesse Fink, the author of the book, didn't say that Bon was a junkie, and that's not the theory that's being put forth. Bond dabbled. He dabbled very, very little at that in heroin. He wasn't even the type to shoot up. He would snort heroin only on occasion. And what the contention is that there were stories surrounding Bond all over the place that were coming from different people on the London party scene. And Jesse found some people that had never been tracked down, and he was able to draw a much clearer picture that it was, in fact, Bond snorting the heroin, and that's why he couldn't be woken up, because he had passed out. Alistair didn't know what to do, so he just freaked and left him there, and that's what killed Bon Scott. He ended up throwing up, choking on his vomit, but it was because he had died of the heroin overdose, that he had so much heroin in his system he was throwing up.
And it could easily have been, obviously, because there were reports and witnesses, he had been drinking, but not to the point where he gave himself blood poisoning from the amount of alcohol in his system, but that there was also a witness saying that he wanted to be pointed to a place where he could go buy some heroin. So that's
exactly
a part of the official record.
Right. And there's people that would say that didn't know about Bon Scott and didn't know about AC/DC, which you say they were a hard partying band. And someone would just say, he didn't drink more than he normally drank that night. And there's those that say, well, why wasn't heroin detected in the autopsy? Now, first of all, back then, AC/DC wasn't the AC/DC of now. They were gaining popularity, but it's not like Bon was this incredibly famous person.
No.
That there was going to be this strong inquest or a deep dive into his death. I mean, he was going to small clubs and bars unbothered for the most part. And the whole inquest was completed in less than 72 hours. And doctors saw that he had a load of alcohol in his stomach and intestines, chalked it up to simply another death by alcohol poisoning.
And let it go at that. But then the inference is, and this is where it gets a little murky, but if somebody were looking to be truly conspiratorial, they might say that elements around Bon Scott wanted him eliminated from the band, and part of their evidence, so-called, for that is that part of the compositions he'd been working on, which ended up on Back in Black, were never attributed to him, and that essentially his material was stolen for Back in Black.
Now, I happen to believe that. I am on the side that thinks that Bon did write the majority of the lyrics to Back in Black, and that's a whole other can of worms, but there was a reported notebook in his apartment in London that had been stolen, and it was never recovered. There's also, and this is a matter of record, that Bon's family gets royalties from the album Back in Black to this day. And when you bring in a guy like Brian Johnson, who had been in some small bands and, you know, nothing that had been substantial, this is a guy who had never written a lyric in his life that was anything of note. And all of a sudden he composes the compositions to the greatest selling hard rock album of all time. Something just isn't right there. And it was never even close to replicated. It's not like after that there was another half a great record or another half a Back in Black. Back in Black is one of these flawless records. They never came close to that again. And even more disturbing is the band told Brian a couple albums later, you don't have to bother with lyrics anymore. We're going to take care of them from now on. And we're meaning Angus and his brother Malcolm Young, the two guitarists in the band. So you're telling me that the guy who wrote the lyrics on Back in Black, these unforgettable songs, that they just say, nah, don't bother writing any more lyrics. We'll handle it from here on out.
Now,
something just doesn't ring true there.
Now, here's the only thing I would say in defense of that is the story is also told that as a writer, he'd run dry. And that he was experiencing a lot of anxiety about trying to come up with something as good as Back in Black, and he couldn't. And so that was why they said, okay, we got it. Don't worry about it. And apparently that was a move for longevity of, like, not wearing out their friend.
I could see that happening, but it's been, I think it, 25 years at this point, and Brian Johnson hasn't come up with one lyric in those 25 years. I get the pressure of trying to follow up an album as iconic as Back in Black. You're never going to do it. But to not have an idea over 25 years of, hey, you know what, guys? How about we throw this one in there?
He
was credited with another lyric for the rest of his time in AC/DC after the mid-90s.
Well, okay. But there's a short list of books and or short stories written by J.D. Salinger. You know, he lives a long time after Catcher in the Rye. But fair enough. Well, this is where I will turn it over to you all. So we'll open up the lines. We'll give you all the numbers. It can be about Eddie Van Halen. It could be about Bon Scott. It could be about any question for a music historian at your beck and call after this. How about that? So we'll give you the numbers to call next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Gina Salvati is answering the phones tonight, which means, you know, it'll take extra long to clear them because people calling out going, hi, Gina. We got to work through the Gina fan club before we can get the calls posted tonight. Although I did hear from Tom Danheiser earlier in the week when he heard who I had booked for tonight. Our guest is Michael Christopher, music historian. We're talking about the legacy of Eddie Van Halen, and had to drop in that story, that update on the death of Bon Scott, because this is, of course, TD's favorite kind of music. He's a hard rocking guy, so he was so bummed he's not here for he had the night off with George, but he did send me his request for a bumper, which I will play later on. We do our best to please, you know. And so it is that we'll get to the phones here coming up in just a moment. You can give your questions to Michael Christopher. But if you're looking for some great shows for tomorrow night, we've got two guests. First hour, Jeff Meldrum. Dr. Jeff Meldrum will follow up on our guest, ML Behrman, from a couple weeks ago when we talked to ML about footprints found in the sand in the Mojave Desert, which looks suspiciously like Bigfoot. And so Dr. Meldrum will give his opinion on that coming up tomorrow night. And then also that Robert Gleason, Bob Gleason, for many people who follow him, a frequent guest on talk shows and a guy who is involved in the publishing business at the executive level, as well as being an author himself. So he does really unusual, cool, new takes on historical research, and that led him to a book which we'll talk about tomorrow night on Mexican slavery, a little known subject, but those are the kind we love the most on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. West of the Rockies, Dan from California is waiting for Michael Christopher, rock music historian. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, how you doing, Ian?
Doing so well. You got Michael ready to go.
Right on. So I used to go to Boise State, and I lived in Anchorage before that, you know, in high school. And we never got any shows. You know, we got Ozzy, which was really cool. We got some shows. But when I went to Boise, we got everybody. And I finally got to see Van Halen. But unfortunately, I got to see them, you know, after David Lee Roth. It was with, you know, Sammy, which I love Sammy. I love Sammy, right? And what's really cool is that Sammy is, you know, like best friends he was with Eddie. You know, they were really close. And Eddie and Diamond Dave, they really weren't that close. You know what I mean?
Well, I think they were. But didn't Eddie and Sammy had a falling out later on? They were buds for a long time, but there was something that came up later on between
them. That happened only because they had an argument, and Eddie went back and got, you know, David Lee Roth to come in and do a couple songs that they had written for Sammy. Yeah, it was kind of, you know, screwed up. But they were, you know, overall, they were really good friends. And, David Lee Roth was just, you know, they say when he first came in the band, he couldn't even hardly sing, you know, and, you know, they, you know, had to really, you know,
work with him.
Right. So anyway, I seen Van Halen and Boise, and it was with Sammy, and then you know what's funny is that David Lee Roth played his tour came right after that, and who was the guitarist for David Lee Roth?
Oh, it was Steve Vai.
It was crazy. It was Steve Vai, exactly.
Yeah.
I was like, who's gonna play Eddie's stuff, you know?
Right.
Steve Vai, and I didn't even know who he was at the time.
Yeah, well, he certainly made history after that. A quick thought on that one, Michael?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Eddie and Alex weren't really friends with Dave. He kind of muscled himself into the band because he had a PA, and they needed a PA to play. So he became their singer, and they were always at odds. And when Sammy came into the band, he was best friends with Eddie. But they did have a falling out in the mid 90s, and that's when Dave came back for one brief little minute. And then, of course, you had the guy Gary Sherman from Extreme.
Oh, that's right.
Sammy came back again in 2004, and that's when they had the really big falling out. They went on tour, sort of the greatest hits tour. They had a couple new songs, but they had a terrible, terrible falling out after that, and they didn't speak again until fairly recently. And of course, Van Halen had been touring with David Lee Roth for the past several years. He came back into the band in 2006, and they had a reunion in 2007. And that whole time, there was this sort of war of words between Eddie and Sammy in the press. But thankfully, Sammy put out a statement this week, and he said that he kind of knew that Eddie was sick, and Eddie reached out to him. They had made up, and they were texting right up until about a month before Eddie passed. And that's when Sammy knew it had gotten really bad, because he kind of wasn't even able to text him anymore.
You know, that's interesting. And I remember Michael Anthony being kind of caught in the middle and siding a little bit with Sammy, who had kind of a jam band thing going after he left. And that didn't settle well with Eddie either, I don't think.
That's one of the reasons why he was ousted from the group. We're talking about Michael Anthony now, because they said, you can't play in another band other than Van Halen. You can't go and play with Sammy. And he was saying, well, we're not doing anything. We're not even recording in the studio now. He said, it doesn't matter. You can't go play with Sammy.
Right.
And then that's when Eddie eventually brought in his son, Wolfgang, which I think he wanted to
do anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Again, show business, high school with money. Wildcard line, Jonathan is in Hackensack on Coast to Coast AM for music historian Michael Christopher. Go ahead.
Hey, you guys. I wanted to make a statement about one of the things about Eddie Van Halen that was so cool and important was, like Ringo Starr, I think he made a lot of people, he inspired a lot of people to want to play the instrument. I used to play with a guy who was very inspired by Eddie Van Halen. He actually had his PRS and, you know, modeled a lot of his guitar playing after his. And there's a few other musicians. I can't really think of them at the moment. But the other thing was, I don't think Bon Scott died of I don't think heroin had anything to do with it. Because I've done heroin before, and snorting it, it's not really going to kill you. I mean, he would have had to have done a lot of it, even combined with alcohol. I do think the freezing in a car aspect probably had a.
It wasn't freezing, though. That's the problem. You know, it really wasn't cold enough that night. And I think that part of the problem is we just don't know what doses we're talking about when we talk about the alcohol in his system plus the heroin, because they didn't really do a very good job on the autopsy chemistry. But I mean, are you saying that you don't believe he was doing heroin that night?
Well, I think if he was, it probably wouldn't be the reason. I wouldn't bet on heroin being the reason why he died.
Okay.
And before I go, I just wanted to ask Michael what he thinks. I work in live music, and how do you see the future? Right now, we're all out of work, and was interested in your opinion on how you see live music coming back into the scene.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, the music right now, the industry has been absolutely leveled by COVID. You have bands that are, the guys that are in the like the Stones or, the AC/DCs, they're fine. But these bands that are playing in the smaller venues or the clubs, they're out of work right now. They can't do anything, and they're trying to find work. And I don't see music coming back the way it was until at least 2022. You just aren't going to be able to put that many people into a small club and pack them in like you did. You see a lot of artists trying to do the social distance shows now, and they're only selling venues at 25% capacity, but you're never going to see a headline act try and do 25% capacity. It would never work. I think it's going to take a long, long time for everyone to recover, and hopefully these small bands are able to do it.
And maybe there's a silver lining out of this, but I haven't found it yet on that whole thing. I mean, it's just bad news all around. Steve's in Abilene, Texas on Coast to Coast AM for Michael Christopher. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Ian. Yeah, I live in Abilene, Texas. I'm about 180 miles west of Dallas. Well, let me tell you a story. In 1984, the Abilene Reporter News had a contest. It was a go find the keychain, and they did a cryptic, puzzle for you to go find a keychain to go to a Jackson 5 concert in Dallas. Well, I figured it out in 5 minutes, and I called my girlfriend, and I said, let's go to the Wind Wedge, which was a it was a these panes of glass in a fountain in the park. And I said, let's go there. That's where it's at. And we searched and searched and searched, and we didn't find him. And I said, well, I guess I'm wrong. Well, the day later, they said, oh, this little smuck found the keys at the Wind Wedge. So he got to go to the concert of the Jackson 5 in 1984 in Dallas. Well, my sister lived in Dallas, and she went to the concert, and the Jackson 5 were playing, and Van Halen was playing Dallas that weekend. Eddie Van Halen snuck over to the Jackson 5 concert and did some numbers with them. And my sister said, oh, it was the best thing ever.
That's great.
I'm like, oh, my God, I was supposed to go. Those were my free tickets. It was terrible. But
yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Mind-blowing, you know. So Eddie snuck over for free.
Yeah.
And played with the Jackson 5 in Dallas in 1984.
Although I think by then they were just the Jacksons. I think they had dropped the 5 sometime when they switched to CBS Records or something like that. But you're right. That would have been amazing. I was a fan of that Dynasty album, of that Jackson's album, and it would have been amazing just to go see that show, and then to have Eddie walk out would have been really, really cool.
That's the only time that Eddie had played live with Michael Jackson. Things just lined up. It was that
really
summer. It was the summer of 84, yeah, and they just happened to both be in Texas at the time. And all of a sudden Eddie comes out, and there he's ripping the solo to Beat It. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime thing for people to see Eddie Van Halen and Michael Jackson play together live.
I remember at the time, the parents were making Michael play with his brothers and sisters.
Right. Yeah.
They're like, because they got to eat too, Michael. So that may have been the last tour he did with the Jacksons for that Dynasty album.
That's a little bit of, they needed some of that trickle-down thrower money to line their pockets.
Yeah, exactly. And invest it well, because it wasn't going to happen again.
Right.
James is in Los Angeles on Coast to Coast AM for Michael Christopher, music historian. Go ahead, James.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, big Van Halen fan, big AC/DC fan. Saw him when I was going to UCLA. Saw the Alarm at UCLA as well when they had the live concert.
I loved the Alarm. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, me too, man. The guitar riffs just aren't the same, you know. But Eddie was the best. I think I probably can blame my tinnitus on it. I had a couple questions for you guys. I remember one concert when I saw AC/DC at the Forum, you know, from the Back in Black album with the Hell's Bells and all that stuff. The discussion was, were they devil worshiping, or was that just all for show? And there was some element supposedly with Van Halen, but I'm not religious at all, so it didn't really bother me. I mean, obviously I'm not going to support devil worshiping, but I think that was just all part of their act. And I just wanted to get your take from the music historian there.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to ask you, mention to you guys that you might find interesting, there was a Music Radar article. It says, it's titled Sammy Hagar, Why I Really Left Van Halen. And he said it came down to the manager change that, you know, I was huge fan of Eddie Van Halen, so I don't like to talk, you know, despairingly about him. But what they were saying, what Sammy Hagar was quoted in that article as saying, is that he was a really humble, meek, mannered guy that just was mostly interested in playing guitar, and he wasn't really a leader. And so they were having difficulties in terms of like scheduling rehearsals and all that kind of stuff. And then they had a change of manager, and he said in that article that he basically poisoned Eddie, and then Eddie started being more assertive, and that kind of like ruined their relationship. But you know, whatever. That's just Sammy Hagar coming up for that article. But I just wanted to know if you guys had heard about it.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The manager's name was Ray Daniels, and he was actually at the time Alex Van Halen's stepbrother. And he managed some bands like, at the time he managed Rush, and coincidentally he managed Extreme. And he started getting into Eddie's head a bit, saying, hey, this is your band, and Sammy's trying to steal this band from you. And it really drove a wedge between Eddie and Sammy, and to the point where Eddie would say, I want to do more hard rock stuff. And Sammy would say, okay, well, here's some hard rock. No, I want to do more ballad stuff. He couldn't do anything to please him. And when they finally went their separate ways, you know, Sammy says he was fired, Eddie says he quit, Ray Daniels said, well, I have a new singer for you. We'll bring in the guy from Extreme. So he was able to it really benefited him more than anything else. And I think that a lot of people do believe that Ray Daniels is the main reason why Sammy Hagar left the band in the first place.
I have a guitar that I kept in my office for many years in rock radio, and then a friend of mine brought out to Starwood in Nashville and kept it in her office. And between the two of us, we collected a lot of autographs on that guitar. And I have Joe Satriani, Eddie, Sammy, and Nuno Betancourt of Extreme, all within about 8 inches of each other on the guitar. It's kind of cool.
Wow. Referring to that AC/DC question, too, you know, AC/DC had gotten the charges of devil worshipping for a long time, especially after the Highway to Hell album came out. And
right.
You had not only
and
that,
the horns on the cover and the whole thing.
Right, exactly. And then with Richard Ramirez, the serial killer in Los Angeles, he said he heard voices and he was inspired by AC/DC's songs. So I think that's where a lot of that got drummed up, and you had the satanic panic of the 80s, and that helped it along. But I don't think AC/DC were ever devil worshippers.
No, I don't think so either. It's very funny. And I think it's even funnier, Lee, you already know the story, I'm sure, but that Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, which, you know, it was an early strong track for them, got a lot of play in the United States, that Dirty Deeds was not based on was not the real story of a hitman. In fact, the song's pretty funny if you read the lyrics. I mean, it's really over the top, and that it was based on the cartoon Beanie and Cecil, which is so funny. And the villain in Beanie and Cecil was Dastardly John. Is that what it was? The character.
Yeah, that was the main baddie or whatever you would call him.
And he handed out his business card, and on his business card it said "Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap," Sundays and holidays cut rate or rate cut or whatever it was, and that always amused the band, and particularly Bon Scott. And I think that's so funny that a lot of people were like, "Oh, that's so evil," and it's like, it's a joke. People, lighten up.
Yeah, it's so interesting where you pull some of the lyrics and the best songs from. They come from the weirdest spots, but people always look for the worst place, you know. But Dirty Deeds, that's another one. I mean, they even had the album named that, but that's where it comes from.
Right. Wildcard Line, Brenda is in Youngstown, Ohio on Coast to Coast AM. You'll probably get the last question in for Michael Christopher, then we'll go to open lines coming up. Brenda?
Okay, good evening, gentlemen, and thank you for taking my call. First, I'd like to offer my condolences to the Eddie Van Halen family. And I have some questions. I'd like to know about Jim Morrison of the Doors. Nobody saw his body except the girlfriend and somebody else that was there in Paris. And they said that for...
We're going to run out of time here. Go ahead real quick, though. What's your question?
And he was in a bathtub in dry ice. I mean, why didn't his family question any of this?
You know what? That's going to have to be an answer that's just going to have to hold out there. We'll have to have Michael Christopher back sometime. I hope you don't mind. I hope you had fun enough to come back and do that with us.
Absolutely. And that Jim Morrison is such a fascinating mystery. I would love to talk about that one night.
All right. Well, very good. We'll do that. And in the meantime, people can link up to you through coasttocoastam.com for tonight's guest. Thank you so much for your thoughts and helping explain the legacy of Eddie Van Halen and more. And open lines coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.